Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the January 4th, 2026 Sunday reading of the Greeley Tribune. My name is Sylvia Merritt. Today, we'll be reading the following main articles. Overnight Operation. U.S. plans to run Venezuela. Maduro and his wife seized from home and taken aboard American warship. By Regina Garcia Cano, Constantine Toropin, and Eric Tucker from the Associated Press. Remembering Bob Toynton, Greeley education advocate dies at 92. A joint public celebration for Bob and Betty Toynton will be held at a later date. By Anne Delaney. Randy Schaefer, A Big Heart. Treatment and prevention of head and neck injuries have evolved since 1975. By Bobby Fernandez. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Overnight Operation. U.S. plans to run Venezuela. Maduro and his wife seized from home and taken aboard American warship. By Regina Garcia Cano, Constantine Toropin, and Eric Tucker from the Associated Press. Caracas, Venezuela. Hours after an audacious military operation that plucked leader Nicolas Maduro from power and removed him from the country, President Donald Trump said Saturday that the United States would run Venezuela at least temporarily and tap its vast oil reserves to sell to other nations. The dramatic action capped an intensive Trump administration pressure campaign on the South American nation and its autocratic leader, and months of secret planning resulting in the most assertive American action to achieve regime change since the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Legal experts immediately raised questions about whether the operation was lawful. Speaking to reporters hours after Maduro's capture, Trump revealed his plans to exploit the leadership void to fix the country's oil infrastructure and sell large amounts of oil to other countries. Maduro and his wife, seized overnight from their home on a military base, were first taken aboard a U.S. warship on their way to face prosecution for a Justice Department indictment accusing them of participating in a narco-terrorism conspiracy. A plane carrying the deposed leader landed late Saturday afternoon in New York. Venezuela's vice president demanded in a speech that the U.S. free Maduro and called him the country's rightful leader. The legal authority for the incursion, done without congressional approval, was not immediately clear, but the Trump administration promoted the ouster as a step toward reducing the flow of dangerous drugs into the U.S. The president touted what he saw as other potential benefits, including a leadership stake in the country and greater control of oil. Trump claimed the U.S. government would help run the country and was already doing so, though there were no immediate signs of that. Venezuelan state TV continued to air pro-Maduro campaign, broadcasting live images of supporters taking to the streets in Caracas in protest. "We're going to run the country until such time as we can do a safe, proper, and judicious transition," Trump said at a Mar-a-Lago news conference where he boasted that this extremely successful operation should serve as warning to anyone who would threaten American sovereignty or endanger American lives. Maduro and other Venezuelan officials were indicted in 2020 on narco-terrorism conspiracy charges, but the Justice Department released a new indictment Saturday of Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, that painted the regime as a corrupt, illegitimate government fueled by a drug trafficking operation that flooded the U.S. with cocaine. The U.S. government does not recognize Maduro as the country's leader. Trump posted a photo on social media showing Maduro wearing a sweatsuit and a blindfold on board the USS Iwo Jima. Early morning attack. The operation followed a months-long Trump administration effort to push the Venezuelan leader, including a major buildup of American forces in the waters of South America and attacks on boats in the Eastern Pacific and Caribbean accused of carrying drugs. Last week, the CIA was behind a drone strike at a docking area believed to have been used by Venezuelan drug cartels, the first known direct operation on Venezuelan soil since the U.S. began strikes in September. Maduro has decried prior military operations as a thinly veiled effort to oust him from power. Taking place 36 years to the day after the 1990 U.S. invasion of Panama that led to the surrender and seizure of a leader, Manuel Antonio Noriega, the Venezuela operation unfolded under the cover of darkness early Saturday as Trump said the U.S. turned off almost all of the lights in the capital city of Caracas, while forces moved in to extract Maduro and his wife. Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said U.S. forces had rehearsed their maneuvers for months, learning everything about Maduro, where he was, what he ate, as well as details of his pets and his clothes. "We think, we develop, we train, we rehearse, we debrief, we rehearse again and again," Kane said. "Not to get it right, but to ensure we cannot get it wrong." Early Saturday, multiple explosions rang out and low-flying aircraft swept through Caracas. Maduro's government accused the U.S. of hitting civilian and military installations, calling it an imperialist attack, and urging citizens to take to the streets. The assault lasted less than 30 minutes, and the explosions, at least seven blasts, sent people rushing into the streets, while others took to social media to report what they saw and heard. Some Venezuelan civilians and members of the military were killed, said Vice President Delcy Rodriguez, without giving a number. Trump said some U.S. forces were injured, but none were killed. Video obtained from Caracas and an unidentified coastal city showed tracers and smoke clouding the landscape, as repeated muted explosions illuminated the night sky. Other footage showed cars passing on a highway as blasts illuminated the hills behind them. The videos were verified by the Associated Press. Smoke was seen rising from the hangar of a military base in Caracas, while another military installation in the capital was without electricity. Under Venezuelan law, Rodriguez would take over for Maduro, but Rodriguez stressed during a Saturday appearance on state television that she did not plan to assume power. She called for Maduro's release and pronounced him president. "There's only one president in Venezuela, and his name is Nicolas Maduro Moros," she said. Some streets in Caracas fill up. Venezuela's ruling party has held power since 1999, when Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez, took office, promising to uplift poor people and later to implement a self-described socialist revolution. Maduro took over when Chavez died in 2013. His 2018 re-election was widely considered a sham because the main opposition parties were banned from participating. During the 2024 election, electoral authorities loyal to the ruling party declared him the winner hours after polls closed. But the opposition gathered overwhelming evidence that he lost by more than 2-1 margin. In a demonstration of how polarizing a figure Maduro is, people variously took to the streets to protest his capture and celebrate it. At a protest in the Venezuelan capital, Caracas Mayor Carmen Melendez joined a crowd demanding Maduro's return. "Maduro, hold on, the people are rising up," the crowd chanted. "We are here, Nicolas Maduro. If you can hear us, we are here." Earlier, armed people and uninformed members of a civilian militia took to the streets of a Caracas neighborhood, long considered a stronghold of the ruling party. In other parts of the city, the streets remained empty hours after the attack. Some areas remained without power, but vehicles moved freely. "How do I feel? Scared, like everyone," said Caracas resident Norris Prada, who sat on an empty avenue looking down at his phone. "Venezuelans woke up scared. Many families couldn't sleep." In the Chilean capital of Santiago, people waved Venezuelan flags and banged pots and pans as vehicles passed by honking at them. In Doral, Florida, home to the largest Venezuelan community in the U.S., people wrapped themselves in Venezuelan flags, ate fried snacks, and cheered as music played. At one point, the crowd chanted "Liberty." Questions of legality. Some legal experts raised immediate concerns about the operation's legality. The UN Security Council, acting on an emergency request from Colombia, planned to hold a meeting on U.S. operations in Venezuela on Monday morning, according to a council diplomat who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss a meeting not yet made public. Lawmakers from both political parties in Congress have raised reservations and flat-out objections to the U.S. attacks on boats suspected of drug smuggling near the Venezuelan coast. Congress has not specifically approved an authorization for the use of military force for such operations in the region. Connecticut Representative Jim Himes, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, said he had seen no evidence that would justify Trump striking Venezuela without approval from Congress and demanded an immediate briefing by the administration on its plan to ensure stability in the region and its legal justification for this decision. Remembering Bob Toyton. Greeley education advocate dies at 92. A joint public celebration for Bob and Betty Toyton will be held at a later date. By Anne Delaney, A-D-E-L-A-N-E-Y at GreeleyTribune.com. Longtime Greeley resident Bob Toyton, who distinguished himself with a deep commitment to both his city and local public education, died December 27th at his home. Toyton, who raised his family with his wife Betty in Greeley beginning in the early 1960s, was 92. Both Kansas natives, the Toytons, moved to Greeley for the second time in 1963, starting their decades-long interest in their adopted hometown through support of the growth and development of downtown and an education at Greeley-Evans School District 6 and the University of Northern Colorado. The Toytons' support was based on both financial investments and donations and on their backgrounds and experience, particularly in education. "What a profound loss," said Bianca Fisher, executive director of the Greeley Downtown Development Authority, a nonprofit promoting the downtown area that evolved from the Toytons' interests starting in the 1970s. "He had an incredible vision and decades-long commitment to downtown Greeley, and it's unparalleled. It was his vision and Betty's that laid the foundation that future generations will continue to build on. That is nothing short of remarkable, and it feels as if words fall flat." Toyton was involved with the Greeley DDA for more than 30 years. Fisher and Toyton began advocating for downtown and considering the future of the area in the 1970s. "He was later responsible for the establishment of the Downtown Development Authority," she added. The family will hold a private graveside service for Bob. Survivors are sons Bill and Brian, daughters-in-law Janie Jill and Judy, a brother Roger and his wife Sherry, 4 grandchildren, 3 great-grandchildren, and a great-great-grandson. A joint celebration of the lives of Bob and Betty will be held at a later date, according to an online obituary written by the family, as well as friend and colleague Travis Gilmore. An announcement of this celebration will be made as soon as more information is available. Betty died during the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020 at age 87. Gilmore is the president of Phelps Toyton Inc., a company Bob founded when Joe Phelps in 1989. Gilmore has known Bob professionally and personally for about 30 years. "Greeley lost one of its best citizens," Gilmore said in a text message. "He was so proud to call Greeley home. He left a legacy that will be felt by future generations." 2 months after Betty's death, Greeley Evans School District 6 decided to name a new building for the Toyton family. The Toyton Academy of Pre-Engineering opened on the 71st Avenue in August 2022. The Academy is a pre-kindergarten through 8th grade school with more than 900 students. District 6 Superintendent Deidre Pilsch said Bob was a longtime friend to the school district. Pilsch, who was hired in 2015, counted him among her first advisors before her contract was finalized. He served on the Business Advisory Council for Pilsch, and he was among the business leaders consulted on the design of mill levy override and bond packages to support large-scale capital expenditures in the district. Pilsch said Toyton's other contributions to the school district included starting the Greeley Dream Team and the Student Recovery Program to help male Latino students who at one time were at a higher risk than peers to drop out of high school. He was honored and humbled to have the school named after him, Pilsch said. I think it was one of the things of which he was most proud. He leaves such a legacy. I was honored to have him in my world and orbit as I came into District 6. In selecting the Toytons as the namesake for the school, the first new building constructed in the school system is more than a decade. District 6 cited Bob's professional career as an engineer. He studied civil engineering at Kansas City State, where he and Betty met in the early 1950s. The Toytons were also supportive of Kansas State University and were honored by their alma mater through the years. They were inducted into the Athletics Hall of Fame in 2006. The couple also supported the College of Health and Human Sciences, the Carl R. Ice College of Engineering, and the Alumni Association, according to the Athletic Department website. All of our student athletes, baseball in particular, have benefited greatly from their generous support, Kansas State Athletic Director Gene Taylor said in their story. Bob will be missed, and the Toyton family will continue to be in our thoughts and prayers. Betty was the daughter of a school superintendent in Kansas, and Bob frequently cited access to education as a reason for his success and accomplishments, according to former educator Janet Alcorn. Having been raised in a farm family, he felt education was life-changing, she said. A kernel of his belief is education is the key to opening doors, Alcorn added. Alcorn spent 25 years as the director of the Toyton Institute for Educational Change at UNC. The institute was founded and funded by the Toytons with donations totaling at least $3.5 million. The institute's 30th anniversary was celebrated in the spring. Alcorn said the Toytons gave $1 million to the university in the mid-1990s to go toward education and leadership. The institute eventually evolved into two academies, one for principals and another for teachers in schools. The Toytons donated another $2.5 million to the institute in 2019, along with other donations through the years, to ease Alcorn's fundraising efforts, she said. Alcorn retired from the director role in July, and Bob continued to engage her in conversation about the programs. They became friends over the years, and he often had dinner with the Alcorns since Betty's death. Alcorn described Bob as humble, thoughtful, generous, and a man who wanted to get things done. He still had a twinkle in his eye any time we talk about the program, Alcorn said of the Toyton Institute. He always attended the academies, and he was the sweetest man. He asked deep questions. He said, if you go back and do nothing differently, then we have failed. Bob and Betty married in December 1955 after Betty graduated from Kansas State. They moved to Greeley the first time in 1959. They relocated to Denver 2 years later and returned to Greeley in 1963 when Bob went to work for Hensel Phelps Construction. Toyton worked for Hensel Phelps from 1963 to 1989, and he was the CEO and president from 1976 to 1989, according to Gilmore. While in Greeley, the Toytons also supported UNC athletics. Among the projects and programs they backed over 36 consecutive years were baseball, men's and women's basketball, football, men's and women's golf, volleyball, the Empower Center, a sports performance facility on the south end of campus near practice fields and Nottingham Field, according to UNC. In a statement, UNC Athletic Director Darren Dunn called Bob a visionary leader, incredible businessman, and a deeply treasured friend of UNC, UNC Athletics, and the city of Greeley. Together, Bob and Benny, they helped shape the fabric of this community through tireless service, generous support, and unwavering belief in the power of opportunity, Dunn wrote. Randy Schaefer, a big heart. Treatment and prevention of head and neck injuries have evolved since 1975. By Bobby Fernandez. BFERNANDEZ at GreeleyTribune.com. Randy Schaefer was unflappable. No matter the circumstances, he was always friendly. He always maintained his faith. He was always positive. In short, he was always Randy. And 50 years after he suffered a life-changing injury, 38 years after he died, fond memories of Randy and the legacy he left behind still live in the hearts of the countless number of people he impacted, here in Greeley and elsewhere. When Randy's mother, Doris, compares the type of person her son was before a severe neck injury on the football field September 18, 1975, left him paralyzed from the neck down, to the type of person he was after the injury, she sees no difference in the person her son was on the inside. Different life circumstances, no doubt. Same Randy. He was calm, and he talked to everybody, Doris recalls. All the young little kids said, "I want to grow up to be like Randy Schaefer." After he got hurt, people would say, "I don't know what to say to him." I would say, "Well, he's still Randy. He's still a human being. He's the same person. Just talk to him like you would before." Randy was the oldest of Doris and her deceased husband Gerald's four children. He had three siblings, sister Tamara and brothers Rodney and Jerry Allen. Jerry Allen died in 2012. 50 years ago, Randy, just 15 years old and 12 days into his sophomore year of high school, jammed his head and neck into the turf while positioning his body low for a tackle in a junior varsity game against Fort Collins. The injury happened just a few feet from Doris and Gerald, who were watching the game from the sidelines while their three other children were at home. "I seen Randy come across the field to try to make the tackle," said Doris, who is now 87 years old. "And the junior varsity field at Greeley West was really holy. The grass was not very good, and Randy was a little pigeon-toed, so that didn't help. There was a dog pile, and when they unpeeled, there was Randy, just laying. I'm looking down. He didn't get up." Doris initially assumed Randy had just had the wind knocked out of him. Longtime area coach and former Greeley West athlete Jim Jorgensen recalls being just a few feet away when the injury happened. Jim is the son of Jules Jorgensen, who died at 90 years old in 2021 and was the coach of the Spartans junior varsity team when Randy was hurt. Jim was playing quarterback in that game while Randy was at linebacker on defense. Jim was on the sidelines during the play as the Spartans defense was on the field. He remembers the scene vividly. "It was third and long, and I'm standing next to my dad," Jorgensen said. "We were playing Fort Collins, and they ran a sweep towards us on the sideline. We kind of just backed up. And literally, Randy landed, basically laying on mine and Dad's feet. And he just kind of rolled up and looked at Dad and says, 'I can't move.'" Even though Jorgensen would have plenty of fond memories of Randy even after the injury, that scene still lingers in Jorgensen's mind to this day. "That was haunting," he said. "It was haunting for my dad, I know, because he always felt that because he was the coach, he was a little responsible for that, which is ridiculous. But it was tough for me, too. I just remember looking into Randy's eyes and seeing the fear that was in his eyes right at that moment." Jorgensen remembers showing up to practice that next day, and about 10 kids on the team decided they were never going to play football again after witnessing Randy's injury. The injury would require Randy to utilize a wheelchair and breathe through a ventilator for the rest of his life. He lived for about another decade after the injury. He died at 26 years old in 1987 after his breathing tube came loose in the middle of the night while he slept. Rodney was 8, Tamara was 10, and Jerry Allen was 13 when Randy was injured. In many ways, each of Randy's three siblings were simply too young to adequately process what had happened to their older brother at the time of the injury. Yet, Rodney very much remembers the precise moment he, Tamara, and Jerry Allen found out about Randy's life-altering injury. I remember my dad coming home that evening and saying, "Hey, Randy got hurt and broke his neck. Mom is up at the hospital," Rodney said. "I'm 8 years old, so I'm thinking, well, he broke his neck, so they'll put a cast on and he'll be right home." Well, they didn't come home. Weeks later, Randy's siblings were finally able to visit Randy, who was now staying at Swedish Medical Center in Denver. "I remember the moment the three of us walked into his room. It was hard," Tamara said. "Walking into his room and seeing your big brother laying on that bed, all the tubes and the breathing machine, we walked in as little, vulnerable, naive kids, and not a word was said, to be honest, because we didn't know what to say. That was pretty much the moment when all our lives truly changed." Doris constantly fought for Randy's life, even when some medical professionals advised her just to let it go. She said she'll always be thankful for the vast support people from all over offered her and her family after Randy's injury. "We heard from people from the East to the West Coast because it was in the national newspapers," she said. "And then the kids Randy went to school with in elementary or out here at Franklin Middle School, they saw it and they sent cards and stuff." To say Randy came from a nurturing household would be an understatement. Doris didn't only take care of her own children, she seemed to care for the entire neighborhood's kids within her warm, welcoming home of 57 years in the heart of Greeley. "All the other kids, their parents weren't concerned," Doris said. "If anybody needed to find their kid, they came here. We had fun. One time, they had a party with Randy and his friend. We had about 60 people in the backyard playing volleyball. My husband made hamburgers and I made a big bowl of potato salad." Though Randy would spend the rest of his life after the injury splitting time between his childhood home and an assisted living and independent facilities, Doris would remain his primary caretaker. She would routinely train nurses on the proper way to care for her son. Ultimately, the entire Schaefer family was well-versed in all that went into caring for Randy on a daily basis. "By the time I was 10, 11 years old, the whole family were like nurses," Rodney said. Doris recalls having a premonition of sorts just a couple days before Randy was injured. "I'm talking to my supervisor at work, and I'm looking out the window," Doris said. "I said, you know, I'm so lucky. I have four healthy children, but I have a feeling one day I'm going to get a big lump. 2 days later, I got my lump. I have premonitions. I also had a premonition about Randy being paralyzed 6 weeks before it happened, but in baseball." In the immediate aftermath of the injury, Randy was transferred from the North Colorado Medical Center to a Swedish medical center. From there, he would ultimately make his way to Craig Rehabilitation Center in Englewood. Embracing a new reality. Before the injury, Randy was a stellar young multi-sport athlete. Even though his injury dashed his hopes of a one day playing sports in college, or maybe even in the pros, Randy never surrendered his friendly demeanor or his ever-positive approach to life. "I never saw him cry once," Tamara said. "He never felt sorry for himself. He never questioned his faith. He never questioned, why me? He always tried so hard. That's how he was. Even in the wheelchair, trying to get out of it, trying to breathe on his own. I think he was a mentor to so many people. He was so positive. He always smiled. You never heard him complain once about the wheelchair, about what he couldn't do, about his circumstances." Tamara said that Randy, always the optimist, almost treated his injury as a blessing. The injury gave him a completely different perspective on life. "When you're 15, you're an athlete, you're strong. Life is great, and you're invincible. You may not have an appreciation for life like you do when something like this happens," she said. He said, "I met people I would never have met. He just had a different perspective because of it, and I think that's a remarkable human being." Brent Pop was a former teammate and lifelong friend of Randy. Not many people experienced Randy's trademark charm and joy more closely than did Pop. Pop said Randy seemed to exude even more positivity after his neck injury. "While most people would be consumed with justifiable sorrow and despair after suffering such a traumatic injury, Randy seemed to gravitate in the opposite direction. And he was just always a positive guy, and I especially noticed that after his injury," Pope said. "I spent a lot of time with him, and in all the years that he was paralyzed, I only saw him down one time. He just had an attitude that he was going to make it. He sure put a smile on everybody's face. Pop can recall sharing times that were so enjoyable with Randy that sometimes Randy had to politely ask his close friend to take a break from making him laugh so much so he could catch his breath via his ventilator. You had to talk with him in between breaths of his ventilator, Pop said. You would get him to laugh so much he'd tell you to stop because he wasn't getting enough air. Nothing stopped him. In addition to always having such a positive mental outlook, Randy would also try to get the most out of his body and out of life itself. He would outright refuse to let his obvious physical limitations hold him down. I would load him up in the van and we'd go out to the lake because he wanted to go fishing with me, Rodney said. We would go down the dirt road and push his wheelchair down there. He would go anywhere, everywhere. Doris recalls that with his kind, welcoming personality, Randy became somewhat of a local celebrity within what was, at the time, a small town. One of the baseball fields at a former local sports complex at Elks Lake was named Randy Schaefer Field. The city of Greeley once dedicated a day of the year to Randy, dubbing it Randy Schaefer Day. When Randy had first come home from the hospital, they had just built the mall. Randy said, "I don't know if I want to go in there. Everybody will look at me." I said, "That's okay. When they look at you, you just turn your head, look at them, and give them a smile." And I heard people say, "There's Randy Schaefer. There's Randy Schaefer." Tamara said that Randy actually loved when young children would run up to him at the mall and ask what happened to him or why he was in that wheelchair. He was always gracious and eager to tell his story. And in his decade plus of life after the injury, not only did he never feel sorry for himself, he never stopped pushing forward. He essentially used to learn his wheelchair as a valuable tool rather than viewing it as a hindrance. He would control that wheelchair, and I have no idea how, just by the pressure of when he would sip on a tube used for navigation and the pressure of when he would puff on it. And he could maneuver that thing, Timmer said. He would cruise all over Greeley. Tamara has fond memories of taking Randy to New Year's Eve celebrations and other social gatherings. She also has a not as fond memory of one time she and Randy were at home alone in the family's backyard on the verge of being caught in an approaching tornado. Randy took charge to assure his younger sister was safe. He said, "Tam, you need to go down to the basement and you need to get in the corner in the bathroom and do this right now." Tamara said, "I told him I'm not leaving you out here. Between our garage and our house, there's a breezeway," he said. "Put me in the breezeway and you go down and you get safe." Tamara refused to leave her big brother behind, so they both tucked into the breezeway, and fortunately, the storm passed before the tornado could reach them. Tamara considered Randy her mentor. He was the perfect big brother. In fact, Randy inspired Tamara to dedicate much of her life to assisting people with disabilities. After the injury, Randy ultimately returned to school to earn his GED certification. He could use a stick to type on a keyboard. He would play backgammon with his siblings. He would paint using his mouth. At one point, he worked from home for Hewlett-Packard. He even flashed some entrepreneur skill by purchasing a soda machine for the family's backyard. He would stock the machine up with beverages that were then routinely purchased by the many guests who came by the Schaefer's frequently visited home. Nothing stopped him, Tamara said. He was an amazing human being. I'm so grateful for the perspective that God gave him and that he got to see life in a whole new way. Appreciation of people, dedication, commitment. That's really where the legacy continues. Randy would also frequently contribute to his church. He and his family have credited their faith for helping him maintain such a positive outlook during his 26 years of life. He had so much faith, Tamara said. He would talk about how he's going to walk again. That was the perspective on how he could continue the journey and use the purpose. A different world. Neither Tamara nor the rest of the family blamed the sport of football for Randy's injury. In fact, Tamara married a pro football player, Reggie Doss, who played in the National Football League for the Los Angeles Rams from 1978 to 88, and even competed in Super Bowl. Still, Tamara and Reggie allowed their three boys to play only flag football rather than tackle football until they were in high school. Even though a high-contact sport like football will never be entirely safe, the medical community has made meaningful advancements in recent decades in regards to preventing, handling, and treating traumatic head and neck injuries on the field. Dr. Saurav Poddar is a sports medicine physician at UC Health, CU Sports Medicine Colorado Center in Denver. He's also an associate professor of family medicine at the University of Colorado Anschutz School of Medicine. He has practiced sports medicine for 26 years. He has also worked as a team physician for the University of Colorado football team for 22 years. Poddar points out that just a year after Schaefer's injury, the act of spearing, leading with the crown of the helmet for a tackle or a block, was banned at the college and high school football levels. The NFL followed suit 3 years ago. That led to a significant drop in quadriplegia cases. It also, seemingly, ignited an effort to continue to modify the rulebook, decade after decade, to further reduce the risk of head and neck injuries. Medicine changes all the time. We continue to try to do better things, Poddar said. But when we're thinking about sports, probably the biggest impact that we make are with rule changes, especially over the past couple decades. Every year, the NFL is looking at, okay, how do we continue to make the game safer for our athletes? There have also been changes in recent decades to the manner in which head and neck injuries are handled the moment they occur on the football field. Poddar said nowadays, during football games at all levels, including high school, there's almost always someone with proper medical training, whether it be an athletic trainer, a physician, and/or paramedics, on the sidelines ready to respond at a moment's notice. Such protocol was far less common 50 years ago when Schaefer suffered his injury. Of course, even the most immediate of medical responses may not be adequate to prevent life-changing injuries like Schaefer's. But these advances, along with a strong push to teach young athletes proper tackling form, aim to significantly curtail the frequency of catastrophic injuries in a sport where contact is king. Things are so different, Poddar said. How the game was played in the 50s, 60s, 70s, even the 80s started evolving in the 90s and 2000s. It will be really interesting to see what is purported with the old guys and how things are going to be moving forward with all these new protections and rules. Yet, another notable factor that has been utilized in recent decades with the hope of reducing head and neck injuries is simply awareness. People in the medical field, the coaching ranks, and even the general population are simply more knowledgeable about head and neck injuries than they were 20, 30, 40 years ago. Rare is the push to play through injuries, which once was a common approach in football and other sports. What might have been once referred to as getting your bell rung just to return to the game a few plays later has been replaced by concussion protocols that sometimes take weeks for an athlete to complete before they return to the field. When I played back in the 70s, I don't know how many concussions I had, Jorgensen said. You would get hit, you would get dinged. I remember going in the wrong huddle one time. I was definitely concussed. I went off to the sideline for about 3 plays, and then I went back in. That's just how it was back then. It was once common practice for a coach to try to revive an unconscious player by simply shaking them, something people now know can significantly worsen the effects of a neck injury. If a young athlete returns home post-game feeling a little loopy after receiving a hit to the head, most adults now know to immediately bring that child to a medical facility rather than assuming their condition will ultimately return to normal. Awareness has really moved the needle, Poddar said, and I see this even from a practical day-to-day standpoint. Athletes a lot of times used to try to hide injuries. It's the tough guy mentality, and you're playing a collision sport. But now they're aware. Along the same lines of awareness, Poddar mentions evolution of strength and conditioning programs that athletes go through in the preseason, which are better designed and optimized now to mitigate the frequency and overall severity of head and neck injuries. A lasting legacy. It might be impossible to find anyone who has a single negative thing to say about Randy Schaefer. Likewise, even as a teenager and young person, Schaefer seemingly never had a bad thing to say about anyone else, even in the most brief, impulsive moments of warranted frustration while near those who were closest to him. Randy never said one bad word. He never cussed me out or spit on me, any of those things, Doris said. When they were wanting to put him in a Denver assisted living facility, he said, "Mom, if they put me in there, I'll die because they don't know how to take care of me." 10.5 years, he was the most perfect patient, and he was determined. He just knew he was going to walk again one day. Jeff Richardson was perhaps Randy's best friend, beginning when they were in Amal Elementary School together. They were locker partners in junior high and in high school before Randy got hurt. Randy had a paper route when he was young before the injury. When Richardson would spend the night at the Schaefer's house, the next morning he would get up early with Randy, ride his bike, and follow behind Randy. Randy would have his newspaper sack hanging from his shoulder as he slung papers from house to house. Richardson would carry another bag full of newspapers while he rode his bike. And when Randy would run out of papers in one sack, he would swap with Richardson and proceed along his route. It's safe to say, wherever you found Randy, Richardson wouldn't be far behind, and vice versa. "He was something special. He had a big heart," Richardson said of Randy. "I think about him often. That man would have went far in life, whether it was in sports, or he would have nailed a really good job and used his head to make a lot of money with whatever career he would have picked up." When Randy was in the hospital after the injury, Richardson would frequently visit him with a group of friends, including Debbie Shaw, Randy's girlfriend at the time. Randy would confide to Richardson that he had one day hoped to marry Debbie. The love that Randy had for his friends, his family, his community, and for life itself was infectious. Everyone around Randy seemed to take after him. "He's really the mentor in my life," Tamara said. "I learned so much from him and from being with him. I am who I am today, spiritually, emotionally, mentally, physically, because of his leadership, our relationship, and his wisdom and advice. Would I have liked another day, week, month, year with him? Yeah. Would I have loved to see him live until 30, 40, 50? Yes, I would have. But I really did treasure every day with him." Greeley Gems. Summit Flight Training Helps Flyers Take to the Sky. By Chris Bolin. CBOLIN at GreeleyTribune.com. Summit Flight Training opened October 30th, 2021 at 722 Airport Road at the Greeley Weld County Airport. Since, many have taken to the sky with what they've learned, from weekend hobby pilots to more than a few now working at major airlines. Co-owner and general manager Jason Edmonds recently spoke with the Greeley Tribune about how Summit Flight Training has grown since its beginning 4 years ago, and how for Summit, customer service is the name of the game. How did Summit Flight Training get its start? Corey Griffin and Andrew Chung, the two original owners, had done some flight training at another school in northern Colorado, and once they had all their ratings, essentially, felt they could do things different. Better. So, they leased this hangar and the ball started rolling. In September 2022, I started working here as the operations manager. Then in June 2023, they approached me about becoming the third owner. What does Summit Flight Training do and what sets the business apart from the rest? We are a full-service flight school and we tailor to all levels of flight experience, from 0 hours all the way up to someone who may just want some refresher courses. If somebody just wants to be a weekend flyer, we can train them to be a weekend pilot. If somebody wants to be a professional pilot and fly for one of the legacy airlines, we can get you to the point of knocking on their door for your interview. I think our business model is what sets us apart from most other places. We pay attention and cater to people. When people call, we answer the phone. When people come to the door, we're here. We want to make flying as accessible to folks as possible. What was a significant moment or event for Summit Flight Training? It's hard to nail down just one, This place has grown from just two people to now maintaining about 80 students. We've been able to purchase two new planes, but I would say the fly-in event we've done for the past 2 years. No matter what level of aviation, there's a little something for everybody to do. You get to see cool planes, meet people, and hang out. We also believe it's brought a lot of awareness to the airport because there are people that have lived in Greeley their whole lives and didn't even know the airport exists 2 miles outside of town. What drives your success? Our customer service, hands down. I know from the number of students that come in here saying, we've called 7 other flight schools throughout northern Colorado and nobody gave us the attention you guys have given us. So it's all about customer service. What are your goals for the future? We'd like to get at least one of these other hangars, which there may be some opportunities within the next year or two, and move in a complete maintenance shop that would be a subsidiary of Summit Flight Training. We've already got a killer maintenance guy. Put him in there and he can do all of our repairs there, plus all the other stuff he does around the airport. Greeley Gems is a weekly feature showcasing the city's businesses and nonprofits. If you have a business or nonprofit you'd like to be featured, email Tribune Entertainment reporter Chris Bolin at cbolin@greeleytribune.com. Front Range. Tax breaks. Can state afford to keep the credits? Program cut poverty for children by 41%. Tabor and other factors trigger pause. By Nick Coltrane. NCOLTRAIN at DenverPost.com. Middle and lower income Coloradans, especially those with children, will receive tax credits worth thousands of dollars when they file their taxes in 2026. But whether those tax breaks continue to erase their financial strain in the years beyond will depend on how lawmakers respond to the state's budgetary turmoil. As the laws are written now, families won't receive the expanded credits when they file taxes in 2027. State lawmakers in recent sessions have made targeted tax credits for lower-income Coloradans and families a priority. The Democratic majority, which occupies nearly two-thirds of the seat in each chamber of the legislature, sees the credits as a potential tool to fight income inequity and lift people out of poverty. Now, they have data to back up that argument. Over the past year, the slew of expanded tax credits helped cut child poverty in Colorado by 40.5%, according to a draft report from Washington University and Appalachian State University researchers. That mark was good enough to give Colorado, which it tied for 6th in the nation in one 2024 study, the lowest rate of childhood poverty in the country, according to the new research scheduled for official release in early 2026. It's so impactful that we help these families who are at the lower end of our economic spectrum, said Senator Chris Colker, a Centennial Democrat who helped run one of the tax credit bills. We have so much wealth in this state and so much poverty. But, he added, math doesn't lie on this stuff. It's what can we afford to do? And that's where lawmakers face a challenge. The prospect of a tight budget year, including the possibility that the state will collect no tax dollars over the revenue cap set by the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights, or TABOR, means Colorado may see a high point in addressing child poverty before it has to pull back those credits. Because of shrinking revenue, the state won't provide its increased match of the Federal Earned Income Tax Credit, or EITC, and is poised to shut off its new Family Affordability Tax Credit, which provides hundreds of dollars in direct payments when Colorados file their taxes in 2027. One of the most powerful tools we have. When Coloradans filed their taxes in 2025, nearly 30,000 filers across every county qualified for the Family Affordability Credit. For an average of $2,700 per filer, more than 330,000 qualified for the state's expanded EITC, for which state tax dollars added 50% to the federal credit, for an average of $1,191. and 127,500 qualified for the child tax credit for about 900 per filer, according to the Department of Revenue. The three credits distribute differing amounts of money to filers based on their income levels and the number of qualified children. Each has its own specific qualifications, such as the amount of earned income reported. Families may be able to claim more than one credit. Those credits will continue to roll out this upcoming tax season. The newest break, the Family Affordability Credit, for instance, will send money to single filers with $15,000 or less in reported income or joint filers who report $26,000 or less. It will provide $3,273 per child under age 6 and $2,455 per children ages 6 to 19. The credit scales down based on income to $123 per younger child and $92 for older children for individual filers making between $80,000 and $85,000. The income limit is $96,000 for joint filers. The federal government set the 2025 poverty line at $32,150 per year for a family of four. For tax year 2024, the Family Affordability Credit and expanded EITC match provided more than $1.2 billion to qualified taxpayers, according to research by the Colorado Department of Revenue. The money for the credits comes from surplus state revenue, meaning that it eats into Tabor sales tax refunds generally due to Coloradans as part of their income tax returns. Those refunds, which return more money to higher-income individuals on the theory that they paid more in excess taxes, will credit $19 to single filers if they report $52,000 or less in income and $59 to those who earn $299,001 or more, the highest income tier. The credits are also designed to shut off if the state budget doesn't grow at a certain clip. This budget year, the state budget's growth is projected to be lower than what's allowed by Tabor because of federal tax changes. Governor Jared Polis has warned that the lower the growth means the tax credits will be shut off. Colorado will cut its match of the federal EITC in half to 25% of the federal credit when residents file their taxes in 2027. State law is written to shut off the Family Affordability Credit altogether if the state doesn't have enough money. The Family Affordability Tax Credit was intentionally designed to be funded only in years when Colorado has a budget surplus. And when we do, it's one of the most powerful tools we have to reduce child poverty and stabilize family budgets, said State Representative Jenny Wilford, a North Glenn Democrat who sponsored the law. This is money that went straight to groceries, rent, utilities, doctor's visits, and back-to-school needs. In a tough budget year, the reality is that this proven credit may not be available, but that doesn't diminish its impact. Rather, it underscores how effective it is when we choose to invest directly in Colorado families. Credits called a model, except for triggers. Reams of research show the effectiveness of direct tax credits like the Earned Income Tax Credit in helping low-income people, said Kathy White, executive director of the Progressive Colorado Fiscal Institute. The credits help people find economic stability from which they can build better futures, versus being stuck in cycles of debt while the cash is also recirculated in local economies, she said. She called Colorado's expanded credits, particularly the Family Affordability Credit, a model for the country. Except for this trigger business, White added, that is not a model. Lawmakers built in a trigger to the credits so that they would compete with other state priorities, such as Medicaid, K-12, education, or the court systems, said White, who advocated for the credits. The recent tax credits were instituted following the flush post-COVID pandemic years, when the state was refunding hundreds of millions of dollars per year to taxpayers. Now, the state is grappling with another divide between rising costs and a cap on how much it can spend via Tabor. Recent changes to the federal tax code, which Colorado's code mirrors, may likewise drop the state below the Tabor cap. That means less money than the state must refund to taxpayers, whether through traditional direct payments or targeted tax credits. The federal changes also put the state budget below the trigger for the credits, jeopardizing them for the 2026 tax year. Thank you for joining us for the Greeley Tribune. My name is Sylvia Merritt.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of AfterSight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Greeley Tribune, please contact them directly at letters@greeleytribune.com or call 970-352-0211.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.